There's a second issue that makes RegTech really interesting to us, and it's a little esoteric, but it's the concept of moving from I think I'm compliant via sampling to I know I'm compliant because of universe testing.
Yeah.
Right now, all mortgage files, there's no universe testing. Sampling is used for any audit process. Sampling is used for any type of verification process. And you know, whether the sampling is done in as unbiased a way as possible, there's always bias. You never know. And so the surety level from an executive management viewpoint of knowing all my mortgage files are compliant versus I tested 10%, I kind of hope, that's huge. And there's some pretty fundamental implications from that.
Barefoot innovation starts right now.
I predict that today's episode is going to be a fan favorite because it is both fascinating and fun. My guest is Miles Reedy, partner at QED Investors in Alexandria, Virginia. Many people know that QED was founded by former leaders of Capital One, including Cap One co-founder Nigel Morris. They have a terrific track record of investing, especially focused on fintech. Miles and I discuss two topics. One is the outlook for RegTech, which he's very excited about, and so am I. And the other, which I know is going to fascinate this audience, is how to find and work with a venture capital firm. On RegTech, Miles talks about the tremendous need for technology that can make compliance both more accurate and less expensive at the same time. He talks about compliance costs that are rising at 20% a year in the industry. He talks about the impossibility of traditional compliance systems preventing the human errors that cause so much difficulty in the industry, including errors in judgment. He talks about how to move beyond the old sampling-based compliance processes and into a world where we're going to be able to use 100% real-time data that can enable banks and financial companies to know for sure that they're in compliance. I am very excited about this too. I think technology is breaking down what used to be a binary choice in which either you had to spend more to get better results, or if you wanted to spend less, you were going to sacrifice performance. That trade-off, as happens in so many areas that technology is transforming, is going away, and we're going to be able to have new strategies that are better and cheaper, both. It's a huge opportunity, and Miles has studied this landscape, and it's full of advice, including some for U.S. regulators. The second half of the show is all about working with VCs. I talk all the time with venture firms, and I've done some angel investing myself, but most of what Miles explains here, I never heard before. He had a startup himself early on, and as he says, he made the trek to Sand Hill Road trying to get funding, and he has the perspective of how to think through the VC investment landscape as both an investor and a startup. He has really provocative insight, most of which comes from seeing people do all these things wrong. His advice ranges from how to approach a VC firm cold, he tells us the one thing to be sure not to do on that, to how to do due diligence on the VC and decide whether they're a good fit for you, and then on to how to work with them when your firm hits problems, which it inevitably will. I think he's especially interesting on what questions to ask a VC from where their funding comes from and where the fund is in its maturity cycle to how it handles adversity. He describes the four typical scenarios for adversity and is very convincing that three of them are really bad. He also has advice on really doing due diligence on the VC firm, including by talking with their companies. The typical startup is so eager to get the money that it can get seduced by that and not really take the time to properly examine whether the investor is actually the right one for them. Miles also explains how he evaluates potential investments, which factors count more than others, what key metrics does he want to be sure that the founders totally understand, what weaknesses does he consider fatal, and once the company is funded, what are the most common mistakes? Which mistakes are most dangerous, say, for a young CEO, which is often the case in fintech firms? And how do you avoid the death trap of hitting the end of the funding runway before you can take off? Hint on that, as he says, to sip on your funds. After we turned off the mic, I asked Miles one more question that people often raise and I had forgotten to cover in the interview, and that was whether fintech and regtech firms should focus on going to the Great East Coast VCs that specialize in the financial realm. Miles mentioned several of them in the episode, or whether it's better to try to get funding from the big famous firms in the Bay Area. There are pros and cons to each in terms of sector knowledge, sector network, reputation power, sort of star quality, and also recruiting talent. And Miles has the answer on this, which is get both. If we were scoring the Barefoot Innovation shows by how many times the guest makes me laugh, I think this one might be the winner. I know you're going to enjoy my conversation with Miles Reedy. I have a fantastic guest today because I have with me, or actually I'm visiting you, Miles Reedy, a partner at QED Investment.
Good morning. Good
Thank
to have you.
Thank you for being my guest today. I'm so excited to
be here.
Very
excited. Well, hopefully you'll still be excited at the end of this.
I'm confident of that. You were already making me laugh when we were out in the hall before we came in, so don't hold back.
All right.
But I was really eager to talk with you. We're out in your beautiful office in Alexandria in a nice old fantastic converted space. Very appealing, and on a beautiful day, and so it's really fun to be together.
It's our pleasure to host you.
So I want to start by asking you just to talk about yourself, your background, and what brought you to being a VC.
What brought me to being a VC is...
Go back farther.
Okay, so I'm a very boring CFO type. Really good at Sudoku, not a lot of fun at parties. Most of my career has been in M&A and financial activities. And so the more relevant experience, I was CFO of Capital One's banking, credit card business, banking business, did a lot of things there, head of planning and strategy there, attempted to retire. My career is actually a series of failed retirements.
Okay.
Because apparently I'm quite annoying to my wife when I'm bored. And since she's a surgeon, I'm very scared of her. So I aborted my retirement from Capital One, and that's where I met all of my partners here at QED, and it was just a fabulous experience. And decided to try retail, so I did something small, became CFO of Sears Holdings. Mm-hmm. Did that for a few years. Realized that the travel just wasn't in it for me. Came back, did some work for General Atlantic, getting them out of a bad investment called Network Solutions, which we sold. A good exit there. Attempted to retire again. Was quickly thrown out of the house. And then at age 50, I got involved with my first startup, which is a very daunting task. It's a very humbling task. Mm-hmm. It's a healthcare-related startup. Called Audex. It's now trading under the name Rally Health. It's a subsidiary of Optum Health from United. It was actually a great experience because I found out a couple things. You know, one, what you do as a Fortune 50 CFO, maybe any type of C-level person, 90% of it doesn't really add value. It's just bucket brigading information from one point to another, and there's very little work you actually do when you're in a startup. There's a lot of stuff you have to do that if you don't do it, it doesn't get done. That was a great experience, I think it actually makes me maybe a slightly better VC because I've had that.
Yeah, I imagine.
So Audax focused on patient engagement metrics and how to get people to actually take better care of themselves through financial type measures. And we sold that to United Healthcare for a very attractive outcome. And again, I went to my wife. I said, "This is it. We're done. I'm here forever." Apparently, she called Nigel, and now I'm a partner here at QED for the past 3 years and having the time of my life.
Yeah, Nigel Morris, the co-founder of Capital One, is one of your
He's one of our partners here.
Exactly. Great. Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Bayou LaBattery, Alabama, so the deep, deep south.
Did you?
If you go any further south, your feet get wet.
Okay, great. So when we talked about doing this, we sort of focused on two topics, although we can go anywhere you feel like going. But one of them is what you are thinking about the landscape for RegTech as an investment and as an innovation in the financial regulatory world. And then the other, which I know our listeners are going to love, is how to work with a VC.
All right. Well, we'll save that last one for last, because that one would be a long and rambling topic. And so, you know, RegTech, and RegTech's a fancy name for just applying technology to the regulatory process. And we're quite excited by this field right now. In fact, we're sponsoring a RegTech conference with Temerity Capital and Fenway Summer in November.
I'll put that in the show notes. I'll be speaking there, looking forward to it.
Which means it's a good conference if you're speaking there. but we think it's a great time. I'm being assisted looking into that by Amaya Scarity, who's a former Assistant Treasury Secretary. But why we think it's exciting is a couple things. You know, one, the pace of regulatory change is beginning to slow. I'm not sure the bar is going to be lowered in terms of the requirements, but the pace of change is slowing. And that allows the frantic pace where most banks or financial entities are just worried about getting hit by the regulatory hammer, and they're just trying to keep their heads above water. They don't have time to think about doing it efficiently. They just have to do it.
Do you think it's slowing globally?
I think it's slowing globally. I think the U.S. is probably slowing more. I think you'll see more innovation outside of the U.S. for the simple fact that in the U.S., it's quite unclear, given the multitude of regulatory agencies, who actually has final say.
Yeah.
Whereas in the U.K. with the FCA or other nations, there's one entity. And that's an immense advantage for driving this. And so I think you're going to see, you know, two-thirds of the innovation come out from London as opposed to the U.S. just because of lack of clarity between state and federal and then the multitude of federal agencies.
Yeah.
But going back to kind of the core reason why we like it, is we think technology is getting to the point where, you know, all compliance is a menu-driven type apps. There's certain things you have to do as a criteria, whether it's KYC, whether it's AML, whether it's some of the other compliance rules, that technology can catch up to that. And just like we're going to see in a lot of white-collar jobs, there's an immense opportunity to automate. And with that automation, you take the judgment out. And a lot of issues with compliance is human judgment. You know, most large multinational banks have tens of thousands of people doing KYC. They're not all doing it the same. And this is an issue. It's not an issue of good or bad intent. It's an issue of human failure. And I think you're going to see immense improvements there in terms of just adding a standardization. And I guess maybe the best kind of a example is credit decisioning here in the U.S. And in the 80s, when I started working, I'm that old, in the 80s, all credit decisioning was done by humans with, you know, checklists and scores. And most banks, whether large or small, had their own consumer credit processes. Through the 90s and on, those decisions have been taken over by algorithms and machines. They're actually better at it. They still make mistakes. They're not perfect. And you saw that most community banks can't compete on a consumer credit offering. Their consumer credit in the U.S. is a national business. I think you're going to see the same thing happen with complex things in the compliance world. The other benefit of putting them on these platforms is the fact that, you know, the ability to make changes as the rules are updated becomes instantaneous, as opposed to I've got to train a bunch of people, I've got turnover, People have muscle memory. I mean, train them, they still go back the old way. I mean, there's a whole host of issues it solves. So I think from an economic viewpoint, it's a really attractive market. You know, most banks are seeing their compliance costs historically go up anywhere from 20% a year. We're seeing it flatten out now, but I think there's a huge opportunity, you know, for cost efficiencies. And the one thing I know about banking is that the margins tomorrow will be smaller than the margins today. So the economic desire to drive those outcomes. There's a second issue that makes RegTech really interesting to us, and it's a little esoteric, but it's the concept of moving from I think I'm compliant via sampling to I know I'm compliant because of universe testing.
Yeah.
Right now, all mortgage files, there's no universe testing. Sampling is used for any audit process. Sampling is used for any type of verification process. And you know, whether the sampling is done in as unbiased a way as possible, there's always bias. You never know. And so the surety level from an executive management viewpoint of knowing all my mortgage files are compliant versus I tested 10%, I kind of hope, that's huge. And there's some pretty fundamental implications from that. You know, one, it'll be really painful when the first universe test happens because we will find stuff we didn't know existed. We will not like those outcomes, but then they'll be over. And if you think about it from a capital allocation viewpoint, if I can reduce the risk of compliance, the fact that we know we don't have those compliance issues or we know we don't have the majority of them, there's a really compelling case to be made to reduce capital requirements for financial institutions because the actual operating risk has decreased. I will probably starve before I see that day come. So I can't really bet on that from the return aspect. But I think just strategically, that's a huge aspect. Banks hold capital for lots of reasons. One of those reasons is compliance risk. If you take that underlying risk away, that's a pretty fundamental change. And that's always good for any type of industry.
Yeah, I think that is so powerful. You and I have talked about this before, but the system is built on sampling today mm-hmm. because that was the best you could do
right.
when the current compliance systems were built.
And sampling's also based on when we had paper files.
Exactly.
I can remember the days doing diligences with buying banks, and you'd go to the law offices, and you'd have the diligence room. And it wasn't these really nice electronic things that you can download. They were stacks and stacks of files. And you had to open them up, and it was just awful. So it's an artifact of how we used to do things. Just like employer-sponsored healthcare in the U.S. is an artifact of wage and price controls from World War II.
Yeah.
The market didn't decide we should have employer-paid healthcare. It was a way for employers to offer better compensation to get the best talent when they couldn't compete on wage.
Yeah, absolutely. There's still some banks with paper files, more mm-hmm. than we might think, too. Big ones, even.
Yeah.
You're right. We're just still doing it the way
Good.
We always did it, partly because the regulation requires certain things and the examination mm-hmm. procedures are the way they
Good.
Are. But now, with data and computing
Okay.
power that we have today in the digital age, we don't need to.
Well, there's also a bit of asymmetric risk. If you do things for compliance in the way you've done it in the past, you haven't done it wrong. If you try to do something new in the hopes of getting efficiencies or reduced capital, all of that is outside the primary aspect of being compliant. You take a lot of risk, and the regulatory hammer can come down. And a lot of these decisions are made by mid-level people in banks who their primary income is their salary. And they, too, have asymmetric risk where, you know, a bank executive might say, we're going to do this, and if they do it right and it works great, they might get a 5% raise. If they do it wrong, they get fired. And so there's some really interesting kind of motivation issues within banks. This stuff in banking will not get done unless it's driven from a C-level person on down.
So how do you see that happening? How are we going to get from here to there? I think you and I agree there's a way to do it better, but how do we get the
Again, I think you're going to see multinationals outside of the U.S. really drive this. Most will do through a proof of concept, where they, you know, no one's going to turn the keys over to a poorly capitalized startup to do something. But I think you're going to see that happen. You know, the U.K. has a very innovative program called the Sandbox, which reduces some of the barriers, but not all. And I think you're going to see that drive, and banks will mimic what they see as success. I don't really expect to see a lot of real innovation here in the U.S. just because of where we are. I see a lot of fast copying, and that actually may be the right way for that to happen here.
Do you think the C-level decision makers have this on their radar yet?
I think some do, and I think what really drives it is how are we going to drive increased earnings in a world where I only have more competition that is assailing my thing, my core franchise. They're going to have to do it to drive earnings, and so you know the core thing of any public company is how do I get more a share price increase to my shareholders. It's probably not going to come from top line. It's going to come from becoming more and more efficient. So I think it will happen. I think you'll see some of the multinationals drive that change. People will see them do it, see they didn't blow up, mm-hmm. say, well, maybe we could take that risk also.
And what areas do you think are most promising for RegTech?
I think I break it into two. Well, we look at RegTech in kind of three columns. There's one column of kind of providing the data to actually do the services. So we provide addresses, we provide name matching. That's interesting. It's a bit of a commodity product, and you're always in a bit of an arms race to I've got to have more data to keep my margins high. From a firm like Self, we're not as interested in those type of businesses. They're great businesses. It's just we don't have the skills to really add a lot of value. The second column is ones that help people do it materially more efficient. And so they actually are workflow management platforms. I think you'll see it in KYC and AML, where those are they're integral to the customer acquisition funnel and management. I also think you'll see it in the back end in terms of compliance documentation management and all of the management. And I also see you'll see it in what's referred to as smart contracts. You know, right now, you know, most financial instruments are really complicated contracts that are actually a version of code in prose.
Yeah, exactly.
They've got financial covenants, they've got rules and a series of if-then statements that a human has to keep track of all that. And usually we fail to do so. So I think there's a lot of opportunity on that back end. And a great example is Brexit. We do a lot of investing in the UK. Mm-hmm. Just about every international contract in the UK probably has to change. And that's a lot of paper.
Wow.
That's an opportunity. Now it's a spot opportunity, but it's a pretty big one. Again, I'm not going to bet on Brexit going through, but those are types of things that we see some real activity. And then the third column is the one that requires some social change, but that's the one that just changes how we do things. So right now, banks can't rely on other banks for KYC. And so if I was to go to Bank A, and open an account, and they verify I'm Miles Reedy, and they give me the account, and then I go to Bank B, it has to get done again, and again, and again, and again, for credit, for deposit, on up. If you had a product that used blockchain or some type of encryption that you could do it once, and you had a service that, as long as I had the right kind of credentials, I'm always me, that's a pretty profound change. It's also a change that takes us a step further of actually giving consumers ownership of their identity. Now, again, that's kind of Pollyannish, but I think we're going that way. I think, you'll see countries like India probably drive that faster than we'll see here in the States because of what they're doing with how they do identification.
Yeah, we just did a recent show with Sanjay Jain, mm-hmm. who helped lead the Aadhaar project in India, which I'll link to in the show mm-hmm. notes as well, again, for people to see it.
But
it's huge, the biometric ID on over 1.2 billion people.
It's an astonishing accomplishment.
Yeah.
It's one that, again, I think will happen here in the States. It'll probably happen at a state level. And it'll be driven by efficiency with state budgets. But I think if I could do something where we did KYC one time, and then I chose which financial institutions could use my credentials, You know, again, from the banking side, that's a huge risk relief because now the consumer is actually involved in who uses their data. That's actually a very profound change.
That's a great point. It's not only the efficiency; it's the reduction of liability
right.
to the consumer.
Right, and it puts some responsibility to a consumer, which means consumers have to understand better what they're getting into. That's not a bad thing. So that third category, which I know is amorphous, and some of the listeners might be rolling their eyes at this point. But to me, that's the most exciting aspect. And we haven't found that company. I doubt we'll find that company. It'll kind of emerge, and we might get lucky if we invest in it. We might not. But for us, that's really the holy grail of this.
I'm sure everyone's listening, hoping that they're going to do that. Before we move beyond what you just covered, when you talk about the smart contracts, do you envision that would typically be a blockchain approach or not necessarily?
Well, if I said I knew it would be a blockchain, I would be a bit facetious in my understanding of the technology. I rely on my son, who's a senior at Carnegie Mellon, to advise me on these things.
I rely on my son as well, which I think you know. Go ahead.
But I think it might be blockchain. It might be something else. The real thing is defining the standards about how it can happen and who actually runs whatever registry you create. Maybe the closest thing is how domain names are registered. There's a central registry that actually is the book of fact that if you're not in that book, you don't own that domain. Mm-hmm. There'll be some utility like that created.
Yeah.
Again, I'm kind of waving my hands, so I don't really know the answer.
Yeah. That's part of the fun of it, though. And then also, when you talk about really all three of the areas, what role do you see for machine learning and AI? Do you think that's going to be central to all of this?
I think it's central. I worry a little bit about like machine learning and AI because they're being tossed around as terms almost to drive higher valuations. So they're replacing cloud, they're replacing millennials. Sometimes, you know, VCs, a little check, we have a kind of, you know, catchword bingo. We go through things. But I think they're just tools.
Yeah.
And I think machine learning is an incredibly important tool, but it's really the subcategories under that. So as if you're a company who's touting machine learning, you really have to be able to say, okay, I say machine learning, you have to say, okay, what it is, where did you get your people who did it? Just say machine learning itself doesn't.
Yeah.
It actually makes me more nervous than less.
Yeah, there is a lot of hand waving. So that kind of is a good segue mm-hmm. into our second topic, but what else on RegTech first?
No, we're really excited. Still very early days. I think RegTech will likely see a lot of early exits to strategics, where you know most of the exits we see now are strategic acquisitions. And so it may have a different return profile than more traditional consumer internet type investing, but I think it's still a really attractive field. The selling cycles are very long, credibility is as important as the ability the tool itself. I think what we'll see is companies that focus as much on the ability to integrate as whatever mousetrap they're building. You know, we'll do better. You know, you can build the greatest mousetrap, whatever that application is. If the bank clients you're selling to don't understand how it easily integrates, you will not sell that product.
Yeah. So before we move to the second set of questions, do you have a sense of how the regulators are coming on board with this? Because as you said, the selling cycles are very long. And that's partly because if you want to, particularly if you're selling to a bank, it's partly because they have a lot of diligence to do, some of which is a regulatory requirement. But there's also, you know, always worry in the bank's mind, what if our regulators don't like this?
Yeah, I think the regulators are coming around that. Like with any new technology, they're nervous. And because you know they don't really have a lot of upside if it works. They got a whole bunch of downside if it doesn't.
Yeah, they're in a hard spot.
Yeah, and they can't pick winners. I think though, if this allows them to do their examinations in a more efficient manner, I think they'll start to come on board. Because, again, they have the same issues with sampling and all the humans that are involved. And they have some pretty profound implications to their workforces if this goes on, where your examination is not sending a whole bunch of people to the bank site. It's, you know, reviewing a big, giant electronic data file. And also the examinations don't happen periodically. They happen all the time.
Exactly.
And so continuous monitoring, just like going from sampling to universe testing, I think they have to figure out how to change the regulatory regime. But I think they can be more efficient. I know with the FCA, we've talked to them. They're very interested in using this as a tool to do their job better.
Yeah, they have a whole reg tech group at the FCA.
And they're quite involved. And again, they can't pick winners, and nor should they.
Right.
But they can help set standards. And that's a huge, huge aid to making this happen.
Yeah. One of the things that excites me about reg tech is that we tend to think about regulation as being a zero-sum game. You're either going to get more regulation that'll help achieve the policy goal that the reg is there for, or if you cut the regulation or the compliance cost, you're going to compromise the public policy goal. If you're trying to catch money laundering, you'll catch less if you spend less.
Right.
And this has the opportunity to break that paradigm.
I think it does.
Do better for less.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
Because we're human, there'll be failings in this. And,
sure.
And there'll be different ways to manipulate it. Now, if I've got everything in the machine, how do I know if I'm a bad bank person or a bad financial person, I didn't have my programmer do something that makes it look like. So there'll be different ways to get around that, and they'll have to work through that. But I think, you know, having all these humans involved is inefficient. And I think the risk of bias there is greater than the risk of bias because I got a piece of code wrong.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Okay, so tell us, before we talk about how to work with a VC, talk a little bit about what you all look for, or, you know, because I know you've got a mix of kinds of companies. Do you want to talk a little bit about your sort of investing profile?
Well, we're a little different. We're a fund that's made up of a bunch of ex-operators pretending to be investors. So none of us started our careers with a desire or a goal or even thought that we would be investment professionals. And there's an arcane language to the investing world. There is a very intricate kabuki dance that goes on. You know, we're learning that, but we're more focused on operating companies. So we look for companies where we think we can add value. We're a bunch of math geeks from Capital One. All the partners are ex-Capital One execs. And we won't invest unless we think we can add value to the company in a way that company's management team wants us to add value. They got to actually want us to do whatever we think we can do. We're primarily fintech. We've branched out in other areas. We keep coming back to the financial world. We actually don't like the fintech name because we think it's just financial services. And we think the traditional banking world and this world will merge. Where each one has a thing they do much more efficiently. You know, traditional fintechs are really good at consumer the speed of consumer, meeting consumer needs, the acquisition funnel. Banks are superior at funding.
Yeah.
And we have been, since this fintech started, we have been in a relatively benign liquidity market. We had one little choppy point, but we haven't been in a bad one. So the benefit of that bank balance sheet hasn't really shown itself. It likely will soon, but merging the two is really exciting. Just like with credit cards. You know, credit cards went from thousands of issuers with no real market dominance to really just a handful of national players that dominate the market, but often do for private label, create products for local banks to put on the balance sheet. I think you're going to see something similar there.
Yeah, I do too. You're right. They've got very complementary strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah. We're primarily A-stage investors because we're a bit agnostic. If we see opportunity at a D-stage, we'll make the investment. We've done some seed. We like to keep our options open.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. What should people understand about finding a good VC and working with one?
I think, raising money it is a distracting and grinding process, but it's really necessary. And a lot of times I see, you know, companies when they come in to talk to us, and I'm we're privileged. I get to see so many smart people. It's a great job. I don't invest in all of them, but it's really, really good. But a lot of them are so intent on getting me to say yes, they miss the fact that this is a two-way street. They need to be essentially interviewing me as much as I'm interviewing them. They need to make sure that I'm a good fit. Because once they take my money, they're stuck with me. And if we've made a bad mismatch decision, it ends tragically. We're not happy, and life's too short. And so the one thing I always, you know, tell people when they come talk to us is ask me questions. All of us VCs will always say wonderful things. You know, we're very experienced. We'll help you out. I've got, you know, blah, blah, blah. So the one thing I say is trust but verify. You know, if I say we can help you with consumer analytics or we can help you with talent, you should write it down in your little notebook. You should ask me for a couple specific examples. If I wave my hands, that's a warning light. If I say company X did Y, go call company X after the fact and say, hey, hi, what was your experience with them? Don't just take it on word. Also realize that the larger the firm, you know, firms have great reputations. Sometimes firms have not so good. But firms are, it's the partner in your relationship that drives the relationship. And partners are very different. So, you know, there's no monolithic version of QED. We all have different versions. Some of us are good at some things and I'm not so good at others. Make sure you understand which partner you're getting.
But on the point about the larger VCs, you're saying that you're less likely to get that patient.
No, I think, you know, people will say, you know, I don't want to use any names because if I use names, I'll forget somebody and I'll get in trouble.
Yeah.
But you know, large firms have the benefit of having typically very large capital pools, but they have, you know, lots of partners, and all humans are different. And different partners are at different stages in their careers and will be formed differently. So they all don't behave the same.
I see what you're saying. So then it really depends on, not the firm, it's the...
Yeah, because a lot of small companies, you know, go for these big names because they think it's validating. Mm-hmm. I got X to invest in me, I must look... And it works to a degree. You know, it might flip a 50-50 tie, but after that, it's the partner. You know, whoever he or she is, that's really the person that you're working with. That's the brand. You can't rely on a general image. You have to really know what that partner's like. And like all humans, all of us have strengths and weaknesses. And so as you do your diligence, you know, diligence the partner as well as the firm.
Great.
And that's important. It's not to dig up dirt about people. It's just understand, you know, how they handle different situations. Another thing that people don't ask is they don't understand often why a firm is investing in them. And we could say, well, they're going to invest in me to make money. That's a little too simplistic. And so you need to really kind of question firm is why, Miles, are you investing in RegTech? I gave some outcome of it before, but is it thesis driven? You know, do I think this is the segment that's going to really change? That's really the best kind of motivation. Is it based on a past relationship? We've done business before. I trust you. I'm going to invest. That's good too. Am I doing it for pure financial logic? I just see a great return. I've never done this before. This looks really good. That's okay, but that's brittle. Because the second that I don't see that return, I'm likely not going to be around. And so understanding the reason why they're investing in you and not being arrogant, well, they're investing in me because I'm the greatest company in the world. No, they're investing because they see something. Really understand that and probe. Three other points. Understand the fund. You know, firms have funds. Funds have finite lives. You know, where is that fund in its investment profile? We've just started Fund 4. It's very early in its profile. It's got a long way to run. You might be dealing with a firm that's in Fund X, but it's really the last 6 months of that. And that has implications as to how much capital they've reserved for follow-on, where they're going to be. Just understand where it is in its life cycle. Ask them where they get their money. Where does your money come from?
That's a big difference.
It's usually not a copy machine that they're printing it off of and the floor thing. Usually. Usually. But understand, you know, what investors they have, what promises they've made to investors, how they've explained how they're going to invest that money in the fund. That kind of goes back to why they're investing in this your particular company. Mm-hmm. And the most important question is, well, when do you have to give it back? Because you should never be surprised by a liquidity event forced by your investors. It happens a lot. Again, no one's being bad, but you should really understand, you know, the life cycle of the fund. That's actually more important for private equity and growth funds where the life cycles tend to be shorter. But just understanding that the economics of the of the fund itself, and you don't need, don't get into the carry and all that, the personal economics. That's really not relevant for you. But just understand the mechanics of the fund so that you can anticipate behavior. It's kind of obvious, but a lot of people just don't do it. And it can lead to mismatches or surprises 3 to 4 years down the road. And typically that's the most important part of a VC investment is that time period.
Do you think that most VCs try to convey this if the person doesn't want to ask?
I think they do, but often it may not register.
Yeah.
And it's really not the VC's responsibility to make sure that and the company knows all the time frames. So we're all trying to drive to good financial outcomes. And it's picking a firm where you think your motives, and I'm using hand signal, which doesn't convey, your motives and the firm's motives stay together the longest point of time.
Yeah.
You're going to take a picture. This is really bad.
Got the hand signal.
Okay. But you know, because over time, when we first start, we all love each other. No one purposely makes a bad investment.
Yeah.
Just like no one purposely makes a bad loan. They happen. Yeah. And if we go apart, you know, that will happen. But you want to try to maximize that distance where we're aligned. I think the fourth thing, it's really kind of on this trust and verify. Very rarely do people ask me this. But how does a firm handle adversity? This will be a shock. Not every VC investment works out. Again, I'll let everybody compose themselves because I'm sure they're probably falling out of it. And every VC makes mistakes or has outcomes that they were not good outcomes. It's really important to know how the firm behaved during those times. Everybody's a genius when things work out. Everybody likes each other when things work out.
Yeah.
How do they behave in the chip? Characters revealed not from success but from adversity. And really probing on that, you know, looking at the past investments the company's made, looking at the ones they made 3 years ago, well, they're not on the website, finding out and tracking down, how did the company behave? We pride ourselves on trying to roll up our sleeves and work out the hard times. And we actually have companies that have failed. We lost all our money. We use as references. We use the CEO as a reference. Now, the one I give you as a reference might be my sample might be biased, but you should figure that out because it's important for the CEO of a company to understand who they can count on and who they can't. And it's not a good or a bad thing. As VCs or any investor, we have a fiduciary duty to our investors to manage their money the best way, and often that may be, I can't do anything else this company. I'm going to stop spending time on it so I can spend time on other investments that have a chance to get my investor a better return. That's the right decision. As a CEO of the company that's struggling, you know, you shouldn't be surprised by that.
Is there a rule of thumb on failure rate for, I know it's a big category, but venture-backed?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. And we don't disclose ours, but we certainly have them. And failures, you know, are ones that you lose all your money. I've had some of those. I can only tell you is that the bad ones come fast, which is actually good because it's all about time. So I don't really have a failure rate number. None of us like to admit it, but it happens. But you know, companies, you know, VCs or investors kind of do four things during bad times. They roll up their sleeves and help. They become belligerent and act aggrieved. Those are the ones you really want to look forward to, that they may use this as an opportunity. Again, it's not. I don't want to make a value judgment. It's good or bad. We don't do that. They go silent, which is probably the majority. It's like, I just can't do anything. You're not listening to my advice, Mr. or Ms. CEO. Via Gindias. Or they actually tell you, I'm going to cut and run. And the ones that do one or four, you know, roll up your sleeves or actually tell you they're just going to go, those are the best ones because you know what they're doing. The ones who kind of sit in the other two categories know what you're getting into.
Interesting.
And then the last thing, and then I'll get off my soapbox, is always be honest with your investors. And that means don't hide issues. Once a firm has made an investment, you've got their money. And if you're not open and honest with what you're struggling with, they can't help you. And more importantly, it starts to erode the trust issue. If I think I have to be a detective with a company to figure out what's going on, that's not a healthy relationship. Because every time they say something, I go, okay, they said it. What is the real answer? And because no one likes to be surprised. And you brought on investors, if you've done your diligence properly, you've brought on investors who may have more experience than you. You should leverage that. And the only way really to leverage that is to be really honest with what's going on. One key we look for is we look at the board packages and do they use the exact same materials they use to manage the company day to day with what they inform the board with, or is it two separate packages? I don't like separate financials. It's a waste of time, and it creates a syncing issue because you know the data can get out of sync, or the data could be cleaned up to present a different image. If you've got good investors, they want to help you solve the problems. If you tell me a problem when it's just beginning, I can fix it. I mean, so I've got my fingers together, they're about an inch apart. If you wait to tell me a problem when it's too big to hide, and my fingers are now 2 feet apart, we've just wasted capital. Because we could have fixed it then and had 10 more shots to get the right answer. Yeah, and if you got the right investors, they'll be supportive of working through issues.
This is fantastic. That was your list because I got
that was
questions.
My list. Okay. That was my list.
Great. Where do you find your companies? I know people find you if you've got money available, but
you need to be constantly out in the market. And my partner Frank Rodman is a master at this. About both creating really interesting content and also just being always out there and helpful. We try to have really good relationships with VCs. We try to drive things, and just be out there and be known to be helpful. I always tell companies that, sometimes they don't want us to invest or we can't get there. And I just tell them, look, I'm still willing to help you. My only compensation is when you see me selling pencils in the street, you buy two instead of one. And hopefully I've gotten to that part yet, but it's all about really kind of always looking and realizing that you're going to talk to 20 companies for every one you think you might want to make an investment in. But every time you do that, you can try to help those companies. And that, for me, is the funnest part of this job. Mm-hmm. I don't have to do this for financial reasons. I do this, because my wife would kill me if I didn't. But more, it's a teaching job. And it's a real privilege.
And do companies call you guys?
They do. We're spotty on that. We constantly get kind of inbounds on the general website or the LinkedIn ones. One trick for companies, if you're doing a LinkedIn mailing, pick a partner. Don't send it to all the partners, because we do talk to one another, and it makes us nervous.
We're our partners.
We do it every Monday, but be a little thoughtful about how you do that. The other thing we do is we try to have really good relationships with other VCs that we think are like-minded.
I've noticed there's a lot of collegiality among the ones that are interested in financial.
I think so. I think we all come from a very similar heritage, whether it's Capital One or other great firms.
That's true. I could think of several from Cap One.
We're a little biased from Cap One, but it's also, this will sound self-pitying, but it's scary to make investments. You just don't know. It's as much an old-fashioned character loan on the management team as it is the concept. And so having other parties vet that thing, because we all have biases, I'm investing my partner's money. And I hate it when I make a miss. And so I really do value having other investors, whether it's Raj Date or Dan Kimmerling or whoever, really help me get their opinions. I may not agree with them all the time, but I certainly listen to them. And it also helps just kind of ground you. We all fall in love with companies for a whole host of reasons. And sometimes that creates a bias. Like when I go to Money 2020 or one of these conferences, and I see a zillion companies, I take really good notes, but at the end of the day, I've seen 30 companies, and I create a company that doesn't exist. It's got all the good parts of the companies I've seen, and I want to invest in it. I can't find that. But really vetting that idea and stress testing your thesis is something. And you have to be very open to people telling you you're dumb. I do dumb things all the time, so I'm kind of used to that.
In startups, I know you said you mostly typically do A round, so there's a product at least, but can you talk about the art of how you weigh the team versus the concept versus the execution?
Well, it starts with a thesis. So we have to have a thesis why we want to invest in this segment, whether it's a new consumer product, that we look for companies that fit that thesis. So rather than finding a company and building a logic case around it, we start with a thesis about the industry. We think this can be done much better. Here's how we think it can be done. And then we look for companies that may match that. Now, it's not never 100% match, but we start with that. And we think that's important because it's easier to stay intellectually pure on your rationale. Mm-hmm. And then when you talk to the companies, I'll tell you a secret. Look, they're going to show me a 5-year projection. I don't look at it. I can tell you what every 5-year projection looks like. Well, there's two of them. First-time CEOs, year one doesn't look good, and year five looks great. And it's pretty much kind of a 45-degree angle between the two points. Experienced CEOs with their same 5-year projections, ones who have done this more than once, year five looks great, year one looks great, year one looks bad, so does year two. And that's the only difference we see. And then they're all assumptions. What we actually look for, we look at the unit economics. And again, there's a lot of assumptions built in that. But with the unit economics, you can ascertain, does this management team really understand the key levers that drive the business? And can they focus on them to improve them? So if it's an acquisition business, do they understand the acquisition funnel and the key metrics that drive consumers from I click on the website, so I accept the product, and there's like 10 steps in between. And if they're thoughtful about that, that's a really good sign. If they're waving their hands about the unit economics, they might not know what's really going on. And that's a really key kind of a tool we use to assess the management team. Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's always the quality of the management team. And they're human, so it's impossible to be perfect in assessment. But, we would always prefer to invest in an A-quality management team with a B-quality idea than a a team that has the greatest idea in the world, but they're not A quality.
Yeah.
Because it's all about execution. And the company that exists 24 months from now very rarely matches the company we thought we were investing in, because none of us can predict the future.
This is so interesting. Are there other mistakes that you haven't already talked about that people should have in mind?
In terms of dealing with VCs or investors, it's not just
Or starting a company.
Starting a company now.
Might be a whole nother podcast, but go ahead.
And I'm not an expert on that, but it's, being a CEO is very lonely. And that loneliness is often self-imposed out of a feeling you always have to be right. Mm. Your team is always looking for you to be right, or your investors. And you've got to make sure you've got people you trust that you can confide in and discuss your concerns, whether they're investors or mentors. You need that. Very few people can go it alone. So it's a very, very trying thing, and it's also manic. That was the other thing that shocked me in my little dalliance with being in a startup was, at 9 a.m. in the morning, we're all going to die. At 10:30 in the morning, the world's great, it's all solved, and then at 2 o'clock in, we can see the asteroid in the sky coming towards us. It's a manic nature, and you just have to be ready for that. I think it's people should either do startups when they're really, really young or they have a bit of a nest egg that they can take the risk. There's no magic answer. I don't think I could ever go back to a large corporation. In fact, I would be a nightmare one. So this is fun, but you have to be prepared to fail.
Yeah.
Everybody fails.
You see a lot of in tech, and fintech, we see a lot of very young CEOs who they've got something great going, but it's not usually experience with having been a CEO. How did they climb the learning curve?
Making lots of mistakes. And you can see the recent headlines, some of them, being a CEO, especially in an industry that's getting a lot of press, is really seductive. And it may make you think you're more important than you really are, and that can lead to some regrettable behavior choices. Just realize you're human, and at the end of the day, we all get measured on how we treat each other and treat people well. If you don't treat people well, why are you doing this at all?
Yeah. Do you have thoughts on speed of scaling up and growth? Do people make more mistakes by being too aggressive or not aggressive enough, or is it all over the
map? There's no menu for that. I think when people make mistakes, it's when they're behaving in the way they think they should behave as opposed to the way they know they should behave. And so there's this awful show on HBO, the Silicon Valley. People run around and behave that way. There's an image.
I
don't watch TV, so I can make fun of it. But there's a way people think they're supposed to behave.
Yeah.
No, if you don't think it's right, don't do it. You have to be true to yourself. If you do that, you've got the best chance of picking the right answer.
Yeah.
And be very careful with who you choose to accept advice from. And understand their motivations. All humans are self-centered.
Yeah.
Understand the motivations for why they're giving the advice.
Yeah. This is so fascinating. Your insights are way beyond the, it's really...
That's just because I'm old.
Yeah. Is there anything I haven't asked that we should cover?
No. I think your audience is probably asleep by now.
They're not asleep. Oh, somebody asked me to ask you, so don't lose your
thought.
Because I tell people I was going to be talking with a really thoughtful VC. And one of the questions, I think I might know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway, was how do you decide to weigh the kind of the money when the thing is going to become profitable? I'm sure it's different for different businesses, but how long can you be patient
Well, we look at it differently. So I hate growth for growth's sake.
Mm-hmm.
And companies that tell me I'll figure it out, I don't like. Doesn't mean they won't be successful. Maybe my little pea brain can't grasp what they're doing. So how I actually deal with that is going back to the unit economics. And if on a fully loaded basis, they can show me the individual consumer or whatever transaction makes sense, then we could build a great business that actually may dig a hole because of marketing or setup expenses. But if they can't show me that transaction makes sense and walk me through their assumptions that say that don't require, you know, a miracle to happen for that whatever metric to be what they want it to be, then I get comfortable investing and creating short-term losses. But if I can't understand the transaction makes sense, I'm not comfortable doing that. Now, other investors who probably are smarter than me, you know, might, and they're the right investors. So again, I'm not the right investor for that type of company. That somebody else is, and that's part of that company's due diligence to make sure they don't get stuck with a stick in the mud guy like me who keeps saying profits and unit economics when that might not be appropriate or not how they want to run the business.
Yeah. Can you remember what you were going to say before I asked you that?
Oh, no. It comes in the head and goes right out. There's zero retention.
I think I had said, is there anything I didn't ask you that you wanted to say?
No, I think we've covered it. When you bring investors on, it's not just the money they bring. It's themselves. And that is often a more important factor. And so be really, really selective. Also be selective how many times you go. You're going to the market is a grinding process. I, for my little thing, we made the trek to Sand Hill Road. I found it demeaning. And I learned a lot of ways of how not to treat people. So it's a grinding thing. As a CEO, be very careful when you choose to go to market. So when you raise funds, you know, sip on the funds as much as you can. Don't go whole hog, because the biggest issue with fundraising is distraction from the business.
Yeah, I'm glad I asked. That was really good. Okay, I think this was absolutely fantastic. I learned a lot. I learned so much from listening to you, Miles. It was fantastic.
Well, you're very kind to say that. I'm not sure it's true, but thank you very much, and I enjoyed doing this.
Where can people get information about QED?
They can look to our website, QEDinvestors.com.
Okay, and I will put more information on our site, which is jsbarefoot.com.
Excellent.
Miles Reedy, I cannot thank you enough for being my guest today.
It was my pleasure. I look forward to you at the RegTech conference in November.
Absolutely.
Hopefully we'll plug that.
Again, we will link to that in the website as well. The date is the end of November.
It's last Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday in November.
In Washington, D.C.
Yes, ma'am.
And there's sort of a game plan to build this into a major annual event.
We're looking forward to building this. It's a great way for us as investors to learn and meet with all the constituents, both the regulators, the companies, and the clients themselves. And I think that's a pretty unique environment.
Yeah, there's a great lineup of speakers. It's going to be really exciting.
Excellent.
Okay,
right.
Thank you.
Ma'am.
I hope you learned as much as I did from my conversation with Miles Reedy of QED. Watch the exciting RegTech space, and if you're working with or planning to approach a venture fund, I suggest that you take notes. Meanwhile, please remember to review Barefoot Innovation on iTunes and sign up to get our emails that will notify you when we've got the latest podcasts and newsletter and blog posts. Come to jsbarefoot.com for that and for the show notes on today's show. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at Joanne Barefoot and go to my Facebook fan page. And please send in your buck a show to keep Barefoot Innovation going. I am going to be speaking at a great many events this fall. I'm not even sure whether there are enough days in the rest of the year to do all this, but I'm looking forward to seeing you there. I'll be at the Online Lending Policy Summit in September in Washington. I'll be at RegTech Compliance Transformed in October in Brooklyn with Source Media. I will be at BAI Beacon and FinTech Stage in October in Atlanta. If you're a member of the CFSI network and are coming to the network summit, I'm going to do a fireside chat there with Tom Curry in Chicago in October. I'll be speaking at FISCA in October in Las Vegas. I'll be speaking at Money 2020 in October in Las Vegas also. I'm going to MC the Sunday regulatory track. I'm going to host a town hall with the regulators, and I'm going to do a podcast there also and a fireside chat with Chris Woolard of the Financial Conduct Authority talking about their innovation initiatives. Come to Money 2020 on Saturday and come to the regulatory track, which is Sunday. I'll also be at RegTech Rising in London in November. I'll be at the Monetary Authority of Singapore, their huge FinTech Festival in November in Singapore. I'll be at the University of Michigan Conference, November 17th in Ann Arbor, my old alma mater. I will be at RegTech Enable in November in Washington. This is the one that Miles talks about in the podcast episode. Much looking forward to that. It's going to be an important conference. I'll be at the UN ITU Conference on Financial Inclusion in Bangalore. I'll be at FinTech Connect Live in December in London. I'll be at S&P's FinTech Intel in December. And I'm going to be at the Dutch Central Bank December 20 in Amsterdam. I'm also going to try to do a talk in Manila this fall, if I can make that schedule work. We have wonderful shows coming up. I'm going to be talking with Andres Wolberg-Stoke of City FinTech, a fascinating show. I'm going to do one also on the amazing experience that I recently had participating in the U.S. Army's threat casting exercise and learning how to do creative imagining of cyber risk in the future and then pinpointing how to prevent it. I'm also excited to say that at Money 2020, as I mentioned, I'm going to record a show with Christopher Woolard and also one with NerdWallet CEO Tim Chen. Speaking of Money 2020, I'm very proud to say that the firm I've co-founded, Hummingbird RegTech, has been selected to present there in the startup pitch section. So please be sure to come and watch. Meanwhile, keep innovating.